Hello and welcome to another jam-packed and exciting episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I am your host. I am Danny Lobel. I am suffering with asthma attacks here in New York City. It's been bad on the asthma. Maybe you can hear it in my breathing. Maybe you can hear it in my voice. I've had to extend my trip to audition. I was invited to audition for Last Comic Standing for the new season. Something in the past I haven't really been into because I'm not so big on stand-up as a contest, but let's face it, I gotta do anything I can at this point. The career is on life support, and the last season of Last Comic seemed decently. They did a good job with it. It was dignified. And part of it is also fear. You know, fear of exposure, fear if it doesn't go well. You know, put a lot riding on the fact that I'm a comedian and I'm a funny guy, and, you know, it doesn't go well nationally, and people don't see all the millions of times it does go well. You could take one time going bad and everyone go, oh, he's not a good comedian. So that's a fear. You never know. I don't know. I guess I need more confidence. I'm thinking of picking up some confidence. Anyone know where to get it? Confidence. I'm looking for confidence. Donate to the show, please. Go to moderndayphilosophers.net. Make a donation. If you make a donation of $20 or more, I will happily send you some tweaked audio earbuds. Compliments of the good folks at tweakedaudio.com. My best manship went pretty well. I made a speech at my buddy Tony's wedding, which is why I came to New York. Here's a clip. Kylie caught it on her cell phone. Maybe you'll enjoy some good wedding humor. Take a listen.
What can I say about Tony Calvino? In talking about Tony, a few words come to mind. Thoughtful. Caring. Apricots. Atticus. Respectful. Reconstructive surgery. Paleontologist. Conquistador. Now, of course, not all those words apply to Tony. But they all do come to mind when I'm talking about it. Because I have very severe attention deficit. And my mind tends to wander fast. As long as I've known Tony, he has known me. I remember when Tommy McCary, I was there. Of course, they didn't know that I was there. I was wearing a series of different disguises throughout the course of the evening. And they have a pet together, a pet cat. And I bring this up only because if anybody here suffers from cat allergies, you should know how to keep a distance. But enough talk about the weak and sickly. Let's talk about this momentous occasion. A wedding. Wow. What a thing to have. A wedding is the coming together of two very special people. They want to go to the top of the mountain and scream, provided they're okay with hiking. They want to go to the top of the mountain and they want to scream to the world. Out of all the people out there, I chose this special, wonderful person to bring in front of you and proclaim, this is the best man in the world. I just wanted to say thank you. And you're right. You see, for a long time, I've always thought that I was better than everyone else. Now, it is official. Tony, Carrie, I just want to thank you for putting together this whole event to tell everybody else that the three of us already knew. Your family, your friends, letting them know that I really am the best.
Yeah? Uh-huh. Ain't that something? Well, there you have it. I'm going to keep this intro brief because of the asthma. We are brought to you today by the good folks at Drinkwell, who believe the world is full of healthy people, like you, who still want to have a good time, which is why they created the first multivitamin for people who drink alcohol. When you drink alcohol, alcohol depletes your body of essential vitamins and nutrients, which is part of why it makes you feel bad the next day. Drinkwell is formulated to replenish the lost nutrients, support healthy liver function, process alcohol-induced toxins, and generally help you feel better the next day. Are you skeptical? Well, don't be. Go to Amazon and check out their reviews, and your skepticism will melt away. And if it doesn't work for you, just email Drinkwell and they'll send you a complete refund, including shipping. No product to send back, no forms to fill out. You can pretty much rip them off if you like, but don't. They're good folks. Drinkwell.com. Drinkwell with one L. And while you're there, use promo code MDP for 15% off. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. The product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. Drinkwell does not prevent intoxication, alcohol poisoning, alcohol abuse, or utter stupidity. It's not a hangover cure, but it'll make you feel good the next day. Drink well, folks. When you drink, drink well. Go check it out. It's a good product. I highly recommend it. Also, highly recommended is our other sponsor today, the good folks over at Stand Up Records. Take a listen to this.
Imagine a world where no one ever went hungry. Where you didn't have to choose between clean air and clean water. And where bitter, drunken comedians didn't have to work in small, dark clubs to tell you how severely screwed up everything is. If that kind of world scares you the way it scares us, then we can help. We're StandUpRecords.com. We offer the finest in CDs, DVDs, and merchandise from the best stand-up comedians on Earth. So please give generously. And remember, together we can't save the world. Yeah, no, we can't. So you may as well just buy something funny. That's StandUpRecords.com.
I always enjoy those ads. So there you go. Go pick up some records. Go pick up some Drinkwells. And now I am about to give you my talk with my good buddy Paul Provenza. Paul Provenza is a true comedy man. He's one of these guys who lives, breathes, sleeps, eats, walks, jogs. Did I say eats? Anyway, he's immersed himself in comedy for so many years. Somebody I respect a lot. Somebody who I enjoy talking to. We've had some great talks. I really enjoy his company. And you might know him because he directed and produced the great comedy film, The Aristocrats, or from his awesome show on Showtime, The Green Room with Paul Provenza, or from the great book Satiristas, where he interviewed lots of comedians who you may know and love, George Carlin and Patrice O'Neill, and I don't know, I've read the book, it's full of everybody, Billy Connolly's got, it's just a wonderful book. If you ever want a good book on stand-up and interviews with the great comedians, Satiristas is the one for you. And here it is, my talk with the wonderful and multi-talented Mr. Paul Provenza, right after the intro song. Enjoy!
And welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
How you doing? How you doing? How you feeling?
How are we feeling? How am I feeling?
How are you feeling?
That's a philosophical question.
How are you feeling?
I'm all right. I've been better.
Yeah?
But I've been worse.
What's bothering you?
You know, life. The whole life thing.
Yeah. It's getting
the
to
whole,
you.
The whole life thing. The whole it gets in the way of all the good shit.
Very. That's an Egyptian philosophy, I think.
It should be.
Celebrating the afterlife. Celebrating death.
You know, the whole, I'm sick and tired of just dealing with money and dealing with paperwork and dealing with agencies and rules, and I'm just sick of it. Sick
you gotta of it. Go off the grid, man.
I would love to go off the grid. I would love it. But, you know, if you try and live like Walt Whitman or Henry Thoreau, you'd get arrested in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
They'd be like, you know, you can't build that cabin. You need a permit for the sewage, and you need to file this form and that form, and you can't live like them.
You got to go out of the country for that. Right?
I don't even think there's any place you can go for that anymore.
You got to find somewhere no one's discovered yet.
I'm just waiting for the apocalypse. Then everything opens up.
Yeah?
Yeah.
A lot more housing opportunities that you
a lot more real estate opens up.
Apocalyptic real estate. You know that there'll be guys jump on that too.
Be re-remax.
Yeah.
I don't know. Dealing with a real estate broker during the apocalypse might be even more of a nightmare.
That's a setless topic, if ever. Post-apocalyptic real estate.
So tell us about Setlist. Setlist is really cool.
Tell the
good folks out there about Setlist.
Yeah, Setlist is great fun. Setlist is actually driven by philosophy. It actually is. It's a very Zen experience. It was the creation of evil genius Troy Conrad, who called me one day and said, "I'm doing this wacky show. I'd love for you to come and do it." It was maybe the second or third time he had it on its feet. And I go, "What is it?" And he goes, "Well, I write the set list and you improv the set that goes with it." Right. And I was like, "That is the worst idea I have ever heard. I'll be there." And I just went crazy. As I was doing it, I was like, "This is the most amazing thing." I was seeing the audience was having an experience I never had before. I was having an experience I never had before. I literally finished my set list, walked backstage and said to Troy, "Would you do me the honor of partnering with me? Because this show has got to go around the world. Every comedian on earth has got to do this." And I also said, at some point, it's going to be a TV show. And if somebody's not here to protect it, it's going to get fucked up. And he said, "Let's do it." And from that moment on, it's been the focus of my life. It's yeah. been what I've been focused on professionally and personally for like 3 years now. But the philosophical aspect of it is that it's a very Zen thing. You know, comics have to really get to that place where they've let go of outcome. Mm-hmm. They're the perfect place to be as an artist is unselfconscious self-awareness. Gotta be there yeah. to do set lists. You have to get out of your own way, let your talent just emerge. And it really screws with comics' heads. It's really, really amazing.
Is that what appeals the most?
I think that's what really appeals to evil genius Troy Conrad. I think he loves watching comics squirm and sweat because he lives his whole life as an improv.
Right.
Troy is actually living in an improv state.
Right.
But it's done really amazing things for comics.
It makes them relinquish control. That's probably...
That's huge. Letting go of outcome and control is huge. And that's especially hard for comedians. Because we're all about control, really. If you think about it, we do is control.
In a strange way, you heard about the show and you're like, "Let me control this. Let me
kind of, kind of." I was controlling it by not letting it get controlled.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Well, see, we're back in the land of conundrums, which is seems to be where I thrive. I love a good conundrum,
and that's why life is beating you down.
Oh man. It is. I've always been an existentialist, speaking of philosophically motivated. I am, I've always been an existentialist. I literally wake up every morning and go, "What the fuck? What am I here for again? What do I have to do today?" And that's why all the minutia drives me crazy.
And you're constantly questioning. That's how you have to be.
Yeah, and you go through the minutia of day to day, and when you really stop and, you know, if you're in the moment, you're dealing with the minutia, you can't help but step out of the moment and go, "What the fuck am I doing this for? What a waste of human life and existence is this?" Yeah, it's not easy being me.
It's just a matter of, I think, people constantly looking for what they don't have, too. I've started to sort of try and appreciate the things that I've taken for granted for that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you could just get completely wrapped up in what there isn't instead of what there is.
Oh, man, you hit the nail on the head. That's right? It. That's about being in the moment. Just what isn't is completely irrelevant. What is everything. Yeah.
I think about that with aliens, Paul. Like, people like get so excited in all these movies. The aliens are coming. And the aliens are just another kind of creature that we don't have here.
Yeah.
There's a zoo down the road, and there's a ton of creatures there that nobody even knows about, but just because they're there, no one cares.
That's interesting.
What if people found out that giraffes were aliens, you know? Would everybody start going back to the zoo? Just if you remarketed giraffes to the public and said, "We found out that these giraffes are actually alien creatures." People, "Oh, I gotta go see the aliens."
I'm trying to imagine the movie. Giraffe NATO.
Sorry, we had it all wrong with aliens. They don't look like us at all, and they're not interested in taking over. They just want to reach leaves on tall trees.
Well, that's always one of, like, imagine being the first Westerner in, you know, the wilds of Africa to see a giraffe or an ostrich or an elephant. It was like going back to the camp, you know.
Right.
"Hey, you're not going to believe this. I saw this, like, cow with, like, a 20-foot neck. Would you knock it off? We're very busy here. Stop it." We got a lot of exploring to do. We don't have time for your nonsense. No, I'm telling you, I saw this cow that was like 1,000 pounds with a nose. It's like 7 feet long. Tom, we don't have time for this. Seriously.
Why are they so
what
busy?
What were you eating the berries? Did you eat the berries again? No, yeah. I saw this chicken. It was like 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
And runs 100 miles an hour. Look, Tom, would you get Tom off my back? I got to get this expedition moving.
But as soon as they find the giraffes, they don't care. Like, lock them up and...
Yeah. Tick that off.
Yeah.
We got the long neck horse.
I think that's fascinating enough. We don't need to look for aliens. We got giraffes.
I don't know. Yeah. Look, that's the whole science religion question right there. Like, why are you making shit up? Isn't the shit that's here fascinating enough?
Yeah. That's true. But even on the other side of the argument, appreciate what's here, you know?
Yep.
Just based on what's here, try and discover more about it.
Yep.
You know?
I'm with you.
Even if you're arguing the religious angle, you don't need to worry about what isn't here.
Mm-hmm.
Analyze what is here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, people spend so much time worried about the afterlife that this life is fucked up.
Yeah.
It's just sort of basic, isn't it? It's kind of fundamental.
I've thought about that too a lot. Like, what if in the next life, they're just getting you motivated for the life after that?
It's a never-ending cycle. Oh, no, it's like pilot season. You got a reading for the afterlife, but it's in the valley. Oh, shit.
In the valley.
Oh, I got to go all the way to Burbank at 4 p.m. Oh, jeez.
So let's go back to the protecting... What do you think it is that motivates you to be a protector of purity?
I don't know. I just found it really beautiful. And I do have to tell you about this. This is a little bit of the backstory as to why Setlist meant so much to me and resonated so much is that I reached a certain point in my life, I would say probably around my 40s, where I realized, you know, my life is at least half over, you know, and... I've been obsessed with comedy since childhood, like 6, 7 years old. And for reaching that point in life where I realized, you know, I'm never going to contribute anything to the art form in the way that I respond to. You know, it's that, again, another conundrum is it's really hard for me to have an epiphany. If, you know, for each of us to create our own epiphany is really hard because there's too much self-awareness and self-consciousness and all of that. We know what we know. So where is the epiphany going to come from? It's, right. You know, everything's filtered through our own set of references and experiences and understandings. So I just felt like the kind of work that I wish I could do, the kind of work that moves me powerfully in comedy, I don't feel like I'm ever going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So I decided, with my life being half over, that what I would do with the rest of my life is give back to comedy, because comedy really did save my life. Comedy really gave me a raison d'etre. It just became why I'm here. And so I decided that I would give something back in whatever way I could, to whatever end, whether nobody is moved by any of it except for me, or millions of people moved by it, whatever. That's just what I decided to do, was give something back. And it was in that time period that I did The Aristocrats and then started doing The Green Room live before it became a TV show. I did it at a lot of festivals around the world and stuff, and Satiristas. And Setlist. And all those projects came from that point where I decided whatever it is that I do, I want it to be something that gives back to comedy. Louis C.K. gives back to comedy just by doing his comedy. I don't feel that kind of talent. I don't feel that kind of amazing gift that I can do anything that moves comedy forward in my own comedy. But I am able to find comedy within comedy,
yeah,
that I feel might be something. And where this comes from is after I did The Aristocrats, I was talking with somebody just about the business of it, because everybody thinks The Aristocrats made me rich and famous. The Aristocrats was huge by anybody's standard, really, for a small little film that, you know, you can't even show a clip of on TV. But I really made no money on it. And I was would often talk about that just in terms of explaining how complex the business of releasing a film is. And somebody said, but you know that none of that matters really, right? And I said, absolutely. And they said, no, I don't know if you really understand that none of that matters. And I said, go where you're going. And he said, you remember when you were 13, 14, 15 years old and you were living, breathing, eating, shitting comedy? And you like voraciously consumed whatever you could. You sought out what you didn't have. And those were the days before the internet. So, you know, that was a passion beyond belief. And I was like, yes, of course I remember that time. He said, okay, remember being that kid. Now imagine being that kid and being able to watch The Aristocrats. And what would that do for you? And I was like, well, that's exactly it right there. You know, it's not about reaching millions of people. It's about reaching the people you reach, you know? And if it moves people, changes people, touches people in some way, whatever. And I don't mean in terms of, oh, the movie was so beautiful, I cried, whatever. I'm talking about it resonates. It speaks to you in some way that you may never understand, but it pushes you in a certain direction. What I tried to do with The Aristocrats and everything that I've done since then, everything high profile anyway that I've done since then, has been all about trying to give somebody the opportunity to have the experience that I had when I discovered comedy and it became my life's work. Like, whatever you do with that experience, I wanted to communicate it so you could do whatever you, whatever, however that moves you. But for me, that's where it comes from. It comes from that experience or that feeling of, oh my God, I've discovered an alternative way to be in the world.
I think it's very relevant that it came out of giving.
Well, I think that's big. That's a big part of comedy that I know a lot of comedians don't like to talk about, but some of the more philosophically minded or more mature comedians, it tends to be comedians, older comedians who really understand this. There is a real giving in what we do. I mean, just giving somebody a laugh, that's a huge gift. That's a huge gift. We don't think about it. Just as humans, we don't think about what a meaningful gift that is.
It's the intention. Sometimes you're giving, but you're meaning to take. Sometimes you're meaning to give, and you wind up taking.
Well, see, that's the other interesting thing. And I had a long conversation with Drew Carey about this that unfortunately didn't make it into Satiristas, and I was bummed about that. One of the other things that I'm really fascinated by that's a big motivation for me is this sort of Zen notion of egolessness. You know, as Drew Carey was talking about it, it's like, you know, how do you do comedy that's not unkind? How do you do comedy that's not about power or control or having a some sort of a viewpoint that's above? Or, you know, how can you be other without being egotistical? You know, how do you embrace it? It's just an interesting philosophical notion, how you actually execute egolessness in comedy. And all performers, how do you do that? Is any performer, how do you do that? And so that's an interesting journey. That's part of a kind of manifesto that I feel sort of amorphously in a lot of my work, is how to make this about egolessness, which is one of the things that I tried to do on The Green Room, was really break everybody down, really put their egos in the back seat. And more often than not, I feel like we accomplished that. Yeah.
How was that accomplished most effectively? What was the best method for getting rid of ego?
Well, it's not one thing in particular. Getting comics to be real, like the way they are with each other. Like, you and I have had some really personal conversations about our lives, about our hearts, about our souls, our feelings, our families, all that sort of stuff, you know? We've all had those conversations with people, but how you get them to be that kind of a conversationalist and have that kind of conversation with an audience there, just intuitively I sensed there's egolessness in that. And trying to get comedians to be that way in front of an audience, I always describe it, it's like trying to get pandas to mate in captivity. You know, if there's one thing off, it ain't happening. If the temperature's 2 degrees too hot or too cold, you know, if there's the wrong kind of leaf in there, it ain't going to happen, right? You know? And so it's more of a feeling and a vibe thing. And one of the ways I did that was by having to be really open myself, you know, having to put myself on the line too. So in trying to create a space of egolessness, I had to become as close. I had to strive towards egolessness. I won't say I ever achieved it, because I don't even know what it looks like, but it's certainly where I, you know, what I strive towards. So that's an interesting philosophical aspect to everything I'm doing these
days. Yeah, it seems like it connects. It's got the same hypothesis behind the set list, which is, you know, let go of outcome and drop this self-consciousness. And
right. And that relates back to what I was talking about, is how do you have an epiphany from your own head and heart?
You said one thing that I don't know that I agree with. And when you talk about Louis C.K.
Yeah.
And him having this talent, it sounded to me like you're saying, well, I don't know if I have that to give back. But what if you do and you just haven't tapped into it yet?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that that's all about that whole notion of, you know, any path you take is there's an infinite number of paths you didn't take and you'll never know for sure. Mm-hmm. But what I did realize was that there is some place where I am original. And that was a wonderful feeling. Like, I'll refer back to the Aristocrats, if I may. You know, that is very much, that movie is very much me. And given the same idea, the same cast, the same everything and anything, nobody would have created that particular iteration of it.
What do you think the essence of the movie is that speaks the most loudly to who you are?
That's a really good question. The essence of it, I think, is my love for the form and for the people who do it, and my lack of judgment for the different varieties of it. You know, when I started doing comedy, I was one of those real snobby comics. I was like, you know, oh, guitar act, pff, you know, you do impression, pff, you know, you do set up punchline, blah, you know, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And I've grown a lot to realize how really small-minded that is. And what I think the essential element of the Aristocrats that really speaks of me is this incredible openness and heart and love for the form and the people who do it and the creative process, you know. And also my respect for each person's individuality. That was the biggest part of cutting the movie. And I cut it with Emery, a comedian himself, who also does. Oh, you have? Okay, yeah. Great. And, you know, we would spend a lot of time going, this is really funny. This is a great little sequence, but there's something about it that's wrong. There's something about it that doesn't feel right, you know, or disingenuous in some way, you know. So we really, really spent a lot of time trying to be really, really, for lack of a better word, pure, mm-hmm. In terms of really respecting somebody's individuality. So we spent a lot of time really honing in on who the individual is, mm-hmm. and that can't help but open you up in some way.
It comes back to that purity thing.
Yeah,
every time.
Yeah, in a way.
There is a quest for purity, for good shit. I also found it interesting when you talked about this transition you had from being a guy who judged comedians, the musical acts, this and that, to being someone who is open to it all, is essentially shedding your ego.
Yeah, well, yeah, so, to a large degree, I suppose that's true. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about words that are so ethereal anyway, really, because ego means different things to different people.
Right, you know? But it seems
I always felt
like
that
a
was
theme.
A weird thing about life, is when people talk about love,
right?
We all talk about love as if we all have the same definition. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the problem right there.
right,
you know, same kind of thing. These kinds of things, I, you know, that's why it's all very, it's very intuitive. It's very personal. It has to do with my interpretation of it for me. You know.
Mm-hmm. So, what does ego mean to you?
It's this. Again, I can't put it into words, and that I'm happy about that because it means that. It has to be expressed another way. And that's what I was talking about. Like, for me, I found originality in areas that aren't necessarily getting up on stage and telling jokes. They're these weird interpretations of experiences and iterations. I mean, that's one of the things we tried to do in the green room, is not do, and also for the TV series of Setlist, which is on in the UK. We're not on in America yet, but we're looking to do that. Mm-hmm. But in the UK version of it, and Green Room as well, we chose to not do a presentational TV show, but to create an experience that the viewer, the cameras, are privy to. You know, the best comedy in your life always, whenever you're trying to tell somebody about it, it always ends up with you going, you had to be there.
Right.
That's always the best stuff. You can't communicate it. You just had to be there. And with set list, it's always you had to be there. This will never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's also a response for me against the plasticity of everything around us. I, it's one of the reasons why I really love live theater. You know, when you're seeing live theater and you're seeing an actor or an actress really go someplace and really have an experience that's extreme and intense, it affects you because you're in the room with it. Do you know what I mean?
Right, sure.
That's what, look, when you think back on the old Johnny Carson show, right? What's the stuff you remember? You remember Buddy Hackett going, doing something that there's no way Johnny would have ever known he would have done. You remember Rickles coming on doing whatever. You know, it was all the stuff that was, in a sense, dangerous. It wasn't predictable. It wasn't obvious. It wasn't just another day at the office.
That spontaneity that people are missing now.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I just feel culture is so formulaic, and everything's sort of rammed down our throat as things to buy and spend money on. And, you know, it always makes me think of, in Satiristas, actually, I included this quote from Doug Stanhope where he goes, every time you get up on stage to tell a joke, you're a whore. You're just a whore. He goes, you know, what real comedy is us sitting around this table making each other laugh. I'm not asking you to buy a CD if you enjoyed laughing with me right now. I'm not trying to sell you T-shirts. He goes, real comedy is when you make that guy stocking the shelves at Walmart, who's in the 7th hour of his 8-hour shift, who's had a shitty day and has a shitty life, you make him laugh out of nowhere. That's mm-hmm. real comedy. He goes, and you don't want a penny for it.
In a way, you found this creative fulfillment in...
In appreciating others, yeah.
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 And in tapping into what you appreciated in your own childhood,
yeah.
You're sort of now giving to the kid who is the young Paul Provenza.
That's actually something that I'm consciously aware of, yeah. It's all about finding, you know, this 14-year-old kid who is the next Louis C.K., who is the next George Carlin, who is the next Chris Rock, who is the next Dick Gregory, who is the next Woody Allen, you know. Who knows what's going to turn them into that? Could be an old episode of Fernwood Tonight, could be The Aristocrats, could be your podcast. Who knows? Mm-hmm. We're all putting it out there for those people.
It's like you're trying to find the next Jedi warrior. He's out there somewhere. Just, you're gonna
whatever.
Attract the one.
Yeah. 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 I think that's what all artists do.
The old guru is trying to find the one. We've been waiting for you. We lured
that's
you
right.
in.
That's right. I am starting to walk a little Yoda-like.
Cool, let's jump into the philosophy. Alex picked a guy for you named Saul Kripke.
It sounds like a name I might have heard, but then again, he could have been the guy that worked at Art's Deli.
Yeah, Saul Kripke, the guy, the pastrami on rye guy.
Yeah.
He said, what you have in common with him is because your show, The Set List, is about following your comedy instincts, he picked a philosopher who talked about intuition.
All right.
So, a prior knowledge pronounced a priori.
A priori knowledge, yeah.
You know about that?
Yeah.
Is that Italian?
It's Latin.
Latin?
Yeah.
The Jews, we don't know about these words either.
That's only human history.
Yeah.
No need for you to know about it.
They keep those away from us. A priori.
Before the fact, yeah.
I already feel like some Illuminati shit. It's like...
Illuminati. Also Latin.
I'm on the inside, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's intuition. Such as all bachelors are unmarried, you don't have to see the actual products to know the formula works.
Well, that's what I mean about epiphanies, is that you have an a priori knowledge and understanding of the way your mind is working and where the connections come from, whatever. Let me see what this says here. A priori knowledge is intuition, such as all bachelors are unmarried. You don't have to see the actual products to know the formula works. A posteriori knowledge is after the fact. You need to experience and work to solve, to learn what the reality is, such as some bachelors I have met are unhappy. Okay. A priori thoughts are often considered necessarily true because they are so easily seen as true. Like, it's an a priori thought that the sun is going to rise tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
While a posteriori is dependent on content. If the sun doesn't rise and happens to be an eclipse, you only mm-hmm. know that after the fact. You didn't know it beforehand.
Okay.
Kripke disagrees with Kant. Kant says that a priori knowledge is always necessary because it's based on the form of a thing, meaning its ideal incarnation, while a posteriori knowledge is based on experience and may only be true sometimes. Okay. Back to our bachelor analogy. It is absolutely true by definition that bachelors are unmarried, but the statement some bachelors I have met are unhappy has a lot more variables in it. Kripke says this does not matter because what is true is true. Kripke says that a posteriori truths can be just as necessary as a priori, such as all water is H2O. We must use scientific data a posteriori to know this, and it is still necessarily true in all cases. Well, that's a mouthful.
So let's go over the first bit first.
Yeah. But that's a big bit.
There's a priori knowledge.
Yeah.
And what was the other one?
A posteriori.
A posteriori knowledge.
Right.
A posteriori knowledge.
Kinda. Hey, you got a nice a posteriori.
Yeah, you got. Do you speak Italian?
I do not.
Your family do? Do yeah, they?
Yes.
Provenza is like a real Italian.
I was raised in a time of where the immigrant experience was about assimilating. Mm-hmm. So, like, my mother spoke Italian with my aunts and my grandmother, but my father would always say, don't speak Italian in the house, you know.
It's interesting. So it was like a shame to it in a way.
I wouldn't say that. It was more about wanting to assimilate. I don't think that we're into some a priori, a posteriori shit here. I don't think that necessarily means there's any shame involved. It was a very positive thing to become an American,
but the pride
of
was,
Italian descent.
The
but
pride was
be
not
American.
In being Italian. In other words,
it wasn't that there was a lack of pride. It was more a practical thing. Like if you want to, we live here and speak the language, and you know, let go of what you've left behind. It wasn't from shame. It was just a sort of social cultural thing. So it was just a time, you know. But back to Kripke.
A posteriori, is that...
Yeah.
That's experience?
Yeah, and evidence, and it's... Yeah. Yeah, I'm also... obviously, your friend also knows that I'm a big skeptic and atheist, and I do a lot of work with various groups in that arena. So the idea of science being a posteriori, and in this context is sort of he's very aware of who I am. That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, he does his research well.
I'm a little humbled. Yeah, but I don't know what to say about it because it's so wordy that I'm not really sure what there is to say.
I mean, what can we break down from it? Basically, the first bit is going in with prior knowledge. The second part is coming in from experience and evidence.
The a priori is sort of intuition. Like you just know. I know you had this thing. You walk into a room, and you just know it's going to go badly.
He's just saying if you feel something's gone a certain way 10 times, you expect it's going to go that same way the 11th time.
Right.
And that's a priori.
A priori.
It's not coming off the Jewish tongue very easily. So then Alex here. Then he gives us a paragraph from Immanuel Kant.
Immanuel Kant.
Yeah, that's how I learned him with Ari Shaffir. We just called him Kant the whole time. And then we have Kripke's rebuttal quote paragraph.
So, that all our knowledge begins with experience, there can be no doubt. All right, buying that. For how is it possible that the faculty of cognition should be awakened into exercise otherwise than by means of objects which affected our senses? And partly of themselves produce representations, partly rouse our powers of understanding into activity to compare, to connect, and separate
slow down,
these.
Slow down, I'm getting
See, this
left.
Is why, you know, I started out as a philosophy major in college.
Really?
But this right here is why I left.
Well, this is the toughest. I guess you got to take it piecemeal.
Well, that's all one sentence.
Yeah, let's break the sentence up. Let's break it up. What do we got at the beginning?
All right, so what he's saying is how else can you know anything other than it having affected you in some way, affected your senses, created your understanding.
Right.
You compare, you connect, you separate all the things that you've experienced. Okay, we get that, right?
Okay.
In respect of time, therefore, no knowledge of ours is antecedent to experience. You can't know anything until you've experienced it. But again, you know, there's a whole thing about what know means in philosophy. It's a whole different thing.
It's like love.
Kinda. Therefore, no knowledge of ours is antecedent to experience, but begins with it. But though all our knowledge begins with experience, it by no means follows that it all arises out of experience. For on the contrary, it is quite possible that our empirical knowledge is a compound of that which we receive through impressions and that which the faculty of cognition supplies from itself.
Again, it's saying you might have innate knowledge when you're born. The faculty of cognition must be, you know, supplying for itself. The brain is basically giving itself some knowledge. Does that mean you coming into the world with a base of knowledge just based on your cognition of the world? You're based on your processing?
I'm not even sure what you said.
I think he's saying...
It is, therefore, a question which requires close investigation and is not to be answered at first sight, whether there exists a knowledge altogether independent of experience and even of all sensual impressions. Knowledge of this kind is called a priori, in contradiction to empirical knowledge, which has its sources a posteriori, that is, an experience. Okay, so Kant is asking the question whether there exists a knowledge that is independent of your own experience. Is there any knowledge, this is how I'm getting it, is there any knowledge that exists before, for example, if you're a newborn baby and you're kept in seclusion for all of your life, is there some inherent knowledge that you would have even though you've had no experience?
They had to have tried this on somebody, right?
They had to have.
Where's the guy who was kept in the room forever?
Well, here it cites Mengele. No. Mengele did some of these experiments,
Right? Yeah.
Kant quotes Kripke, disagrees with, okay, all thought must directly or indirectly relate to intuitions and to sensibility, because in no other way can an object be given to us. Thoughts without
makes sense. He's saying you have to have some kind of knowledge to process
Your knowledge is. Right. Yeah. Okay. Thoughts without content are empty. Intuitions without concepts are blind. The understanding can intuit nothing. The senses can think nothing. Only through their unison can knowledge arise.
He's saying you have to know something to know something. Mm-hmm. You can't not know anything and then know something. Like, right. You have to have that.
All knowledge is processed through your experience.
The first, a priori, you have to have some a priori knowledge. I guess that's where the word prior comes from, right? Prior knowledge, a priori.
Yeah.
I found a root there.
So you have to have some sort of knowledge in order to be able to interpret what it is that you're considering new knowledge.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Hmm. That's a good question. I wonder, Well, that's sort of, he's using the word intuition a lot, and it's a very weird, I've always wondered about the difference between intuition and instinct.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are things that we consider intuition or something intuitive, are those instinctive responses? Like, you know...
It's like, I think it's like when you get a new cell phone, right?
Yeah.
And you're not reading the instruction manual. You just pick it up and you kind of know how to operate it, even though you've never operated that machine before.
Right. Okay. That's the story of the mouse, the computer mouse.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why that's such an extraordinary design achievement is because we intuitively understand it immediately upon first seeing it. Like the first people who ever encountered the mouse figured it out almost immediately because it was so well designed to be intuitive for us.
Right.
But is that's a chicken and egg question. Is the mouse designed that way because the designers know the way we would approach an object like this?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we approach an object like this because the designers have designed it this way?
Yeah, we don't. There's no way to determine that.
I think that's kind of a better analogy of the a priori, a posteriori thing.
Yeah,
it's interesting because the a priori, a posteriori thing, the whole thing about what you know intuitively versus what you know experientially, what you know organically, all that sort of stuff. Where, how, my brief Googling of it, it seems to resonate for me in this arena of self-awareness, that you can assume that you know things, whether it be a priori or a posteriori, but it takes introspection to know if how you're processing everything is the truth or not. So without answering the a priori, a posteriori question, the question itself is interesting, because do you live your life believing that you know everything you know already, or do you live your life examining everything that you know already? That resonates for me, because I've had to go back and re-examine everything. I've changed a lot, I think. I have a friend who I've known since he started out as a comedian, and he became a writer for many years. He doesn't perform anymore, but I've known him since about 1975, maybe. I met him very early on. We were both starting comedy. I was like 16, 17. And he said something to me recently that I thought it was great, actually. I loved it. He said, of all the people I've known as long as I've known you, you're the least like the person you were when I met you. And that made me feel really good. That made me feel like, all right, well, that's some sort of growth, for better or worse. Right. I'm not going to judge it.
Yeah.
But that says something, you know. And I've definitely seen that in my work. I mean, I look at periods of, like, I look at, you know, tapes from way back when, all the way through, you know, a life of doing TV shots and whatever. And I sit there and I just go, oh, I know who that guy was. I remember him. You know, it's like I see different, yeah, different people at different times, you know,
yeah,
which I guess is good. But it's hard. That has a lot to do with, I think, you know, where I'm at with stand up is just that, like, my voice has changed so many different times. There are some core things, some sort of a priori, if you will, things that are like, they're definitely, you know, they're definitely me, but that has changed and shifted through my own experience and stuff.
Yeah.
That question of, is knowledge a priori or a posteriori, is it experiential or is it innate? That's something that I think introspection is all about, is figure out if you really are living in a truth of some kind, what you believe. It's just, you know, I always question what I believe, totally. I mean, there's a few hard and fast ones for me that I feel like I've questioned enough. I'm pretty good with that.
Like which?
Love and, you know, big stuff, the big basic stuff. Like, I wake up in the morning now and I don't worry about whether or not I'm a decent person. I know I make mistakes, mm-hmm, but I'm pretty sure that I'm a decent person. I'm pretty confident in all my values, and they're all driven by really, I think valuable morals and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, 5 years, who knows how I'll feel. Maybe I'll feel like I was wrong now, you know, I don't know. But yeah, I'm constantly questioning things. That's the existential dilemma that I wake up with every day.
What have you learned about love?
Well, it really is everything. It really is. I mean, I know this sounds, I'm not a Hello Kitty kind of guy, so it's a little weird for me to land in this kind of place, but it really is all about, like, what's the loving choice? What's the loving choice? And that forces egolessness as well. And when you're searching for egolessness, you have to go outside yourself. But then again, there's the other side of the coin, which is very Selfish Gene, the Richard Dawkins book, which is, you know, the double-edged sword, which is that if I want a life full of love, I have to be loving to everybody I come in contact with. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So is that egoless or actually really solipsistic?
Right. It might be selfish.
You know? Yeah. So that takes me to the sort of yin and yang stuff, which is, it's both, they both work together.
Back to the taking by giving.
Yeah, I guess we're sort of in that same territory. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. Instead of taking for the sake of taking, taking as a result of giving.
Yeah.
Which and, seems and, to be the purer way of taking and the better way of taking.
Again, that's value-based, I suppose. Right. You know? So I don't know. There's no definitives. Everybody's got to come to their own place with all that sort of stuff. But I know that, that when I strive to be a loving person, when I strive to, even in conflict, you know, well, okay, what is this conflict? What's the loving way to approach this? How would I like to be dealt with? My aspirations have changed quite a bit. My aspirations really are now just to have everybody that I come into contact with treat me in a loving way, and I have to treat them in a loving way to varying degrees of success and failure. I'm not by any stretch of the imagination suggesting that I know what the fuck I'm doing here. It's all an improv. Every minute is an improv. You know, but that's the thing about improv that's so interesting, is that it's really all about yes anding. It's all about, okay, what is there, not what isn't there. And, you know, how do you move forward with what is? How do you take it to more creativity rather than have it be stifling your creativity or freezing you up or making you afraid or all that sort of stuff? The yes and philosophy, I think, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It is a great way to live life.
But then you also have to figure out when not to say yes. And that's tough.
Exactly. That's where the introspection is. I think at the root of this a priori, a posteriori notion, which is, okay, so if you know something a priori, mm-hmm. you have to be able to trust that, you know? You have to be able to trust that the sun is going to rise every day. And well, how do you do that without experiencing it enough to trust it?
Is that where faith comes in?
I imagine it swims in the same end of the pool.
Mm-hmm. It's just basically like, you feel this, you know this to be true enough times, you have faith it'll happen.
Yeah, I guess. Symbolic logic, a lot of it is semantics. That's one of the reasons why I bailed on philosophy. I'm fascinated by the ideas behind it, but so much of it becomes blurred between the ideas and the language. And language in itself is a huge obstacle. I mean, language is just symbols anyway. We're just talking about representations of ideas. So that gap alone between the ideas and communicating them is a whole world unto itself of philosophical analysis.
Sure.
And I tend to go down rabbit holes, and I was like, for a life, this rabbit hole will kill me. No way I'm doing this.
Yeah. All right. What we have left is we have some of Kant's quotes that Kripke disagrees with.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is, although all our knowledge begins with experience, it does not follow that it arises from experience. So we sort of covered that, you know.
Who knows?
To some extent we have, yeah, right?
We tried.
All thought must directly or indirectly, by way of certain characters, relate ultimately to intuitions. And therefore, with us, to sensibility, because in no other way can an object be given to us?
I don't even know what the hell you're saying.
I don't know either. That doesn't make sense. And I'm not reading it wrong.
Is Kripke still alive?
Well, I didn't get to that yet, but I have it here.
Okay.
He was born November 13th, 1940, and he is still alive. He's currently Mikosh Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at Princeton University. He's a logician. He teaches as a distinguished professor of philosophy at the CUNY Graduate Center. Since the 1960s, Kripke has been a central figure in a number of fields related to mathematical logic, philosophy of language, philosophy of mathematics, metaphysics, epistemology, and set theory, which is not that different than set list, I imagine.
Set theory. Let's do a set theory list.
Much of his work remains unpublished or exists only as tape recordings and privately circulated manuscripts. So you got to be in the end. This is Illuminati shit. Kripke was the recipient of the 2001 Stuck Prize. Stuck Prize. Stuck? S-C-H-O-C-K? Stuck?
All right.
In the 2001 Stuck Prize in Logic and Philosophy. A recent poll conducted among philosophers ranked Kripke among the top 10 most important philosophers of the past 200 years.
I won the Shtick Prize. I don't know if you knew that.
That was given out right as the last Catskill Comics were.
That's right.
And the number one shtick goes to Paul Provenza.
Dick Shawn, ladies and gentlemen.
He did a wonderful shtick. Now, in the Whitefish Room. The Whitefish Room.
So he is still alive. So he didn't die from head exploding.
No.
All right.
He's still going.
All right.
But you got to be on the end to get some of those manuscripts.
So I'm telling you,
you got to know the right people.
He's very underground.
He's made influential and original contributions to logic, especially modal logic.
Modal.
What's
I think
modal?
That's pronounced. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it's pronounced modal.
We'll have to Google that one. Okay. Modal logic is a type of formal logic primarily developed in the 1960s that extends classical propositional and predicate logic to include operators expressing modality. Does that mean anything? For example, a statement,
here.
John is happy, might be qualified by saying that John is usually happy, in which case the term usually is functional as a modal.
Okay. Some sort of a modifier.
I guess so. Oh, yeah, maybe that's the... There. His work profoundly influenced analytical philosophy, with his principle contributing to the semantics for modal logic involving possible worlds, as described in the system now called Kripke semantics.
He's got his own branch of semantics?
Yeah.
Oh, we're dead in the water
that's
here.
That's what happens if you stick with it, Paul.
There's no way we're going to comprehend any of this.
You could have had your own semantics, too. You should have stuck with the philosophy.
I was moving forward with the Shtick Prize. I should have stuck.
His most famous work is Naming and Necessity, which was published in 1980.
Yeah, there's an interesting illustration. I read about that. As Lois Lane believes that Superman can fly, but she believes that Clark Kent can't fly. So even though they're the same entity because of the names... They bring different understandings to the entity.
Mm-hmm.
So which is true?
I think we have to probably conclude at this point that Lois Lane had something mentally wrong with her.
Well, I think it's important to go back even further to acknowledge that they're all fictional characters. That feels somehow significant to me in this.
I mean, what if she's just the stupidest woman around?
Yeah, she's an idiot.
She's the only one who can't recognize the difference of him with or without glasses.
You put a pair of glasses on and you're a whole different entity. She's like a 3-year-old.
It's almost like he was taking advantage of somebody there.
He was. You're right. You're right, which is why he's the Ubermensch. This is heady stuff.
All right, back to our quotes to wrap up.
Trying to make
here.
Sense of how this relates to me because what's your friend's name?
Alex.
Alex, because Alex has inspired me now to figure that out.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll become a whole new Paul by the end of this.
Could be. Could be. I'm certainly going to need a new career.
All the different Pauls get in a room from all the different parts of your life.
That's an interesting idea.
They'll figure it out.
That's a great premise for a play right there.
The different
all the different yous.
Yeah. You got to write out each version of you from over the years.
Oh, my God. That would be horrifying.
Put them all in a room together and let them discuss this and see what they come up with.
Let them argue amongst themselves.
Yeah. You stay out of it.
I'm going to call that play, You're All Assholes.
Thoughts without content are empty. Intuitions without concepts are blind. The understanding can intuit nothing. The senses can think nothing. Only through their unison can knowledge arise. I can't imagine a thought is content, isn't it? Maybe it's not good content.
I don't even understand what a thought without content would look like.
I think I watch TV. You're watching content that isn't there.
It's reality television.
That's it.
That's it.
It's thought without content.
There you go.
That's what these programming executives, that's what you're fighting against. It's thought without content. You're giving people content with thought.
So their thoughts are actually, they actually have thoughtless thoughts.
Thoughtless thoughts.
That's the title of my autobiography.
Thoughtless thoughts.
Thoughtless thoughts.
And what was the play? The Many Me's?
You're all assholes.
You're all assholes. All right. So here we've got one quote from Kripke himself. Those, again, were all quotes from Kant that Kripke disagreed with. any necessary truth, whether a priori or a posteriori, could not have turned out otherwise. What does that mean?
I mean, what he's essentially saying is that all of this is irrelevant. This whole conversation is completely irrelevant. That's what I take from that.
Couldn't have turned out otherwise as a necessary truth?
What is a necessary truth?
Yeah, what's a necessary truth?
I'm telling you, we're in the rabbit hole.
An unnecessary truth is if you tell somebody some shit that's getting you in trouble, you didn't need to tell them. That's an unnecessary truth?
Yeah. Wasn't that an Al Gore movie?
Yeah.
No, it was an inconvenient truth.
An unnecessary truth.
No, I think it, I don't know. Is that the opposite of necessary truth? An unnecessary truth is when you got a rat on yourself.
An unnecessary truth is when you don't need to say nothing. You couldn't keep your mouth shut, but you decide to anyway.
And it's used against you in a court of law.
Yeah. Your Honor, in my defense, it was an unnecessary truth. I didn't need to tell him nothing. I was just trying to be nice.
I'm baffled. I'm baffled by all of it.
I wish I had Kripke's number. He's still around. We can give him a ring. What do you mean by this? You're not in the secret group. You don't get the documents.
It'd be kind of funny to call him up and go, listen, what the hell were you trying to say?
Yeah. It was like that scene from Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield. Remember, he has Kurt Vonnegut come in and give him a report on himself.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then
yeah.
The teacher says, that's not what he meant at all.
Let's call him right now.
All right. Well, while you dial, I'll tell it. I'll wrap.
1-800 shots. 1-800 shtuck prize.
Shtuck. And the shtick prize again this year goes to Henny Youngman. Henny Youngman with the shtick prize. I saw Jerry Lewis recently.
Did you?
He did a show at a theater with a Q&A and showed old clips of his stuff.
Yeah, how was it?
It was incredible. He's so sharp. Yeah. Have you ever met him?
Yes, I have met him. He's interesting. I have a love hate with him because he's one of the reasons I became a comedian. Because when I was a little kid, I had lazy eye, amblyopia, and so I didn't have three dimensional vision. So all my perception was learned. Like I would just be sort of guessing that soda bottle is about there relative to this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always falling down, bumping into things, knocking things over, spilling things. And I went to see Jerry Lewis at the movies and saw that there was a guy who was doing all the stuff that I was getting yelled at for and getting in trouble for. And he was a big movie star and people loved him. And I thought, all right, I got to make it look like it's all my idea.
Really?
Yeah.
That's how it started?
I got to make it funny. Yeah.
That's so funny.
That's honest to God truth. I was about 6 or 7 years old, and that became a conscious thought. So I really have a very, very special place in my heart for Jerry Lewis.
It's so fascinating that what made you become a comedian, in a way, is what still drives you, which is that you didn't know if what you were perceiving was true.
Oh my God, you know, I'd never even put that together that way. You're absolutely right. Yeah. My perceptions have always been suspect. I never even thought of that. Wow, that's great.
That's what it is. That's, yeah. And that's what drives your work. Like when you're trying to make sure that everybody sees the truth. When you're putting together the green room, when you're putting together the set list, the way you shoot it, the Aristocrats. You're like, you're very concerned about people's perception.
And I'm also trying not to impose my own. You know? It's like you don't know what I like or don't like at any given moment in the stuff I'm doing lately. I just put it out there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I really like things that give people the opportunity to have their own interpretation or whatever, which is hard in stand-up. So that's sort of side ways.
Does that come also from not knowing if you can trust your perception?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing about stand-up that's so interesting is you really kind of have to take a position in stand-up. And I'm more interested in the shades of gray. I find them more fascinating just in general.
Yeah. I'm like that too. I'm always too afraid to make a bold statement because I might come back a few years later and be like, sorry about going public with that. I don't think.
Yeah, which like I was saying,
right? Been, the different you will emerge.
Different me's all over the place. So it's like, you know, I'm a little gun shy now of deciding any of them. Yeah,
but I always look back to George Carlin when I think about that, because I go, well, there's always the AM and FM in all of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to change, and it's okay to put out what you believe at the time,
mm-hmm.
and just put it out there as a piece of work in its time of you,
right?
You know,
it was true at the time. Yeah.
So maybe that'll speak to somebody, and maybe you'll look back at it and be like, oh, it was so off the mark, but maybe for somebody it's right, you know. So I hope you find the epiphany you've been looking for.
I'm working for it. I'm going home to read Kripke.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's in there.
It's in there.
It's gotta be. The Wikipedia page is hilarious. It looks like it looks like calculus, because all that symbolic logic stuff.
Right.
Oh my god.
No, I think this is some weird Illuminati shit. I'm pretty sure of it.
It's up. What if the Illuminati were really called the a posteriori?
I don't know what goes on at the Illuminati, but I bet there's pretty good Italian food there. If I can break in as a Jew, I look Italian enough. I got to be
you
able
could
to
totally pull. Be Italian.
Yeah,
you look like a guy who would whack somebody.
You know something? I had my neighbor, also an old Italian woman in Williamsburg, and she thought I was Italian. And my roommate Matty Goldberg. Do you know the comedian Matty Goldberg?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Very funny. He lives out here now too, and he looks very Jewish. He kind of looks like Woody Allen.
Uh-huh.
And she hated him because she hated Jews, but she loved me because she thought I was Italian. And I found all this out because one day she used to sit, I don't know why old Italian people and Mexican people have a habit of sitting in lawn chairs on the sidewalk.
What is that about?
There's some kind of connection there, but I haven't figured it out yet. Well, she'd sit on her lawn chair on the sidewalk, and she calls me over one time, and she goes, you'll be good for my granddaughter, but not this guy. And she points to Maddie. She goes, my granddaughter no need to be with another dirty Jew. A nice Italian boy she need like you.
Fun with racism.
Because Maddie used to always, she had a pretty attractive granddaughter, and Maddie used to always, you know, bust her chops when he'd walk by and be like, when are you going to set me up with your granddaughter? So she pulled me aside. She said, I never set up my granddaughter with this dirty Jew. All right. Thanks, Paul. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I learned a lot about what I don't know.
All right.
I learned a lot about how little I know about anything.
Well, maybe you could at least trust your a priori knowledge. At least you got that going for you, right?
You know where my a priori knowledge is up my posteriori.
I love you, man. Thanks.
Good to see you, buddy.
Well, that's our show, everybody. I want to thank my guest, Paul Prevenza. I want to thank you for tuning in. And I want to thank our sponsors, Drinkwell and Stand Up Records. Go pick up them products. Go get some Drinkwell. Go get some records. Thank you for tuning in. I'm going to keep it brief because of the asthma. A little tough to breathe today. But please, donate to the show, moderndayphilosophers.net. Leave a nice review on iTunes. It's very important. You jump on iTunes, leave a nice review. And it will help the show's visibility. Please. And take care of yourselves. And be well. And I hope to see you next week or talk to you next week. I hope you're all doing okay. Email me. Say hello. Say hello. You know, it's lonely out here in New York. You know, I'm not home. I'm not home in L.A. L.A.'s my new home. Might be from New York, but now I'm an L.A. guy. I don't know what voice I'm doing. It's hard to breathe. Maybe that's what it is. It's a constricted lung guy. TheComical@yahoo.com is my email address. Send me an email. Say hello. Drop a line. Say what's up. I'll see you next week, everybody. Or talk to you next week. You know what I mean. Bye-bye.